Good morning, Portland. You're listening to Outsmart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Also available at TideSmartRadio.com. Also iTunes for podcasts. How are we doing today there, Sully?
Doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Never been happier.
Good.
It is. This broadcast will air on Saturday, September 19th. In just a few minutes, we have a guest, John Rooks. He's CEO of Rapport and founder of Soap Group. Really interesting gentleman. A lot of focus on sustainability and a consulting firm dealing with the intersection of science, culture, and sustainability. So we'll have that in about 4 minutes. And first, what do we have on this day? 1982, emoticons. Interesting. Created by Carnegie Mellon University professor. And think about how much time has been saved instead of, like, you know, writing out words when you can just have a smiley face. Yeah. What else do we have? Birthdays. On this day, Mama Cass would have been celebrating a birthday. She passed away in 1974 at 32. Also on this day, Jimmy Fallon. He's the host of The Tonight Show. He turns 41 on this day. One other kind of note before we get to our interview with John Rooks. Did you see your issue of The Forecaster this week, Zoe?
I saw your headline in The Forecaster.
The headline, The Recipe for Maine's Political Apocalypse, Blueberry Nut Bread. This was a column I wrote, and it's in the current issue of The Forecaster. If you're not able to pick up the paper version of The Forecaster, it's available online. Just go to the Forecaster. I think it's forecaster.net. Everyone talks about it, you know, how everything's the politician's fault and everything's about Paula Page's fault and the people we elect and it's government's fault. But ultimately, I think it's we the people. If we don't make our elected officials accountable, then we kind of get what we deserve in a sad, dysfunctional way. So this week's column, which I am proud of because it put a lot of work into it, I looked into our state legislature, and there's no easy, reasonable way to research voting records of our elected officials.
Well, it should be public record, right?
Well, I mean, it is public record if you go bill by bill by bill, and, you know, between the Senate and the House, there's about 900 roll calls every session. But you can't go to your elected official and say, geez, I wonder how, you know, my elected official did or how he or she voted without spending hours, if not days, kind of extrapolating the information. And when I contacted people at the State House, I talked to about half a dozen. They all said, yeah, it seems kind of crazy, but that's just the way it is.
I think there is a website out there, though, that you can track how U.S. Senate.
Yep.
Votes?
Yeah.
How each senator votes?
Yeah. U.S. Congress is obviously more attention and greater focus. And, you know, but here, and the only information when I went to, as an example, I went to a couple of, specifically a couple of elected officials. I went to my elected state senator for Senate District 25, Kathy Breen. And when you click on her legislative website, you know, there's a tab that says legislation introduced. But between State Senator Millett and Kathy Breen, they introduced 84 legislative bills out of altogether 92 that they were directly involved in. And they all had to do with these sentimental bills, thanking people, congratulating people. And I do think that that can be an important legislative function. But to take so much legislative time creating the bill, researching the bill, putting it through kind of the constitutional steps where it's heard on the floor, it's voted on, just seems like a huge waste of time given everything we have going. So
I agree.
If anyone has any thoughts on that, please look at the column online at The Forecast or pick up a copy and we'll go from there. Well, why don't we get into our interview?
All right.
We had John Rooks here, and here's my interview from earlier in the week with John Rooks. Thank you for listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O.
You know the nearer your destination, the more you slip sliding away. I know a man.
Good morning. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Slip sliding away. You want to hear something, Deb?
Yeah.
I'm a huge Simon and Garfunkel fan.
Yeah.
I mean, they're great. And then Paul Simon was on Colbert, his show this last week.
Yes.
I didn't have any of Paul Simon stuff. It was like this glaring omission from the Steve-O library.
Oh, boy.
I downloaded the Central Paul Simon.
Good for you.
There you go. But I digress. But let's welcome our guest, John Rooks. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
John is the CEO of, is it pronounced Rapport? Is it like Colbert Rapport, where it's Rapport?
Yeah, Rapport.
Rapport, and also the founder of the Soap Group, both organizations. John oversees here from Portland, from Southern Maine, very much involved with sustainability, consulting, working with companies all around the country and possibly the world. He has an excellent YouTube video I recommend we'll get to, as well as writing a book. So before we get to talking about sustainability and energy and Deb's irrational denial of climate change, let's talk a little bit about your background. You know, did you grow up in Maine? How did you end up here in Maine? And then we'll start talking about the work that you do.
Yeah, I grew up in Western Mass, a little town called Harvard, Apple Country.
God, I've been there. Yeah. I grew up in Needham, a little suburb of Boston.
Yeah.
And my only hope of ever going to Harvard would have been driving through your town and saying, yeah, I went to Harvard. You probably get that.
Yeah, we used to play tricks when people would pull into the high school and they asked where the central campus was of Harvard. And we'd send them to the principal's office at the high school.
That's funny. Yeah. Harvard. Yeah. So where'd you end up going to school, and what was the genesis for you being interested in either the environment or the environmental sciences or sustainability?
Yeah, undergrad in Vermont, where I hiked more than anything else, certainly more than I went to class, solid C student. Then went to get my master's at Clarion University in Pennsylvania, where I finally realized that there was something in academics for me. And I got a degree in cultural theory and writing theory. And cultural theory is really just, why do people do things in groups and how do you get them to change? From there, I taught English for a little bit, adjunct at USM. I went and worked for an environmental consulting firm in Boston, where I was marketing and writing for them, became the regional marketing manager selling environmental engineering services. Left there to go work for TerraLink Software Systems, which was a startup at the time up here in Portland. Left there, went to work for an ad agency, a traditional ad agency, and then woke up and said, hey, where'd all that environmental stuff go? I really like that. I'm tired of marketing vinyl windows. And tried to cobble together this little thing that the theory when I started the firm was, I wonder if you could only do work for good clients. And so far, it's been probably 90% true.
And that's Soap, right?
That's Soap. That's the consulting firm. I started that in 2003. And we had this quaint little pastoral tagline at the time. It was marketing for environmental and natural resources. And it was so simple back then. We weren't all tangled up in sustainability and climate change and, at least in the mainstream view, we weren't quite – the language hadn't evolved yet. It was just at the cusp of green marketing. So that's really where we started getting our business, was in that space. And over the time, have added in the science services. So now we can do sort of full sustainability consulting.
We have John Rooks here. Before we get into that, I was fascinated to learn of your work. And obviously, we both work here in Southern Maine, and I viewed your TEDx Deer Ago talk, and first of all, I'm a big supporter of TED, whether it's Big TED or whether it's the regional statewide TED. I think TEDx Deer Ago does a great job and very much true to the format in terms of the content and the type of presentations. But I thought your presentation was excellent, starting with your love of Star Wars and blizzards.
Right.
And it's always interesting what, Deb, did you see the TEDx?
I did. Yes, I did.
It's always interesting learning about, you know, I believe life is one long path, and every hour, day, week, month, year, we're taking different choices along the path, whether it's, you know, highway speed or whether it's more rural. But I'm always fascinated with people's path. I mean, growing up in kind of rural, suburban Massachusetts, mm-hmm. you talked about in your TEDx talk, which is available on YouTube, that you were joking about it, but you were talking about kind of a love of Star Wars, the idea of fantasy or mystery or exploration, and then blizzards, and you made the association with blizzards meant that people would bang on the door from Greenpeace, which I thought, I've never gotten the Greenpeace people. It must be your neighborhood or something.
It must have been an 80s thing, too. I mean, so this was back when they were doing like the Walk for the Whales every year in Boston, so I would always go to that. That was, 82s, right around there when they were coming around and they were knocking the door and looking for donations.
And you were really into whales.
I was a pretty big whale nerd.
There's something, we don't want to spend a lot of time talking about whales, but I also had, I don't want to say a love of whales, because that sounds a little awkward.
A
right
thing?
Now. No, not a profound, I don't want to say spirit, but a profound respect for whales. I was just out in Maui a few months ago and traveling around there, and that was the season where there's, pods of whales all over the place. And there's something about whales, the size, the fact that we're both mammals, and these whales migrate down to a very small area within the Hawaiian Islands, mostly around Maui. But they migrate from the Great Northwest. And when you look at a global map, Maui is tiny. And so these whales are, north in the Pacific Ocean, way up by Alaska. And I asked one of the marine biologists and one of the guides that I was with, like, how do the whales know 3,000-4,000 miles away? Because there's no road maps under the ocean. And he's like, we think that they've got super, deluxe sonar, and they map the sea bottom. But there are places the sea bottom is, thousands of feet deep.
It's genetic resonance.
It's something that's unexplainable. All the they can't figure out, because if you're a whale and you start in the Great Northwest and you get ready to migrate to this little place in Maui, if you're off just a couple of degrees, you don't get there. You end up in Tahiti, which – maybe a good place to be anyhow. I've been there. It's not bad, but it's no Maui. Right.
They have something we don't have, that's for sure.
Well, I know. That's why, I don't want to get into the whole crazy Sea World thing, because they have something. And I think in general, we could do a whole show on this. I think we as humans may be evolving a little bit recently, having more respect for animals, and whether it's SeaWorld, the Ringling Brothers, or the outcry against the crazy dentist that went out and killed the lion just to show off in front of his buddies, just to say, hey, look what I did. There's a whole bunch of quotes saying, the measure of a civilized society is how we treat animals. And I agree with that. But I digress again. We've got John Rooks here. He's CEO of Rapport, founder of Soap Group. So, growing up, you got interested in Greenpeace. You got interested in the environment. You went to school, studied, cultural theory and behavioral science. So then when you came up here, what was it that first brought you here to Maine?
It was lifestyle, like most people. I'd been working in Boston and had a one-year-old daughter and said, this is not the right place to, I was commuting from Worcester into Boston, and it was just too long. And that route
listening to WAAF.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. A little COZ maybe. Yeah.
Mix it up a little.
Yeah.
I grew up in the BCN era.
Yeah.
Where it was like, none of this means anything to you, Deb. You were easy
does.
Listening
I
out.
I used to listen to COZ.
Really?
Yeah.
Back in the day. Fantastic. In the TEDx video, it was, and I apologize, I don't have the name of your TEDx talk. What is it if people wanted to look for it either through TEDx a year ago or on YouTube?
Authenticating real.
Right. You talked about a term which I won't be able to pronounce, but simulacrum.
Simulacrum, yeah.
Simulacrum.
Yeah.
And that is the copy of something that doesn't have an original.
Right.
I think that was a fascinating observation. You used a number of examples. If you could explain a little bit both the term and how it applies, and let's talk a little bit about how that impacts people on a day-to-day basis in terms of marketing messaging and in terms of cultural messaging.
You want to go deep quick.
I want to go deep, John. That's what we do here at Tidesmart.
So the simulacrum is a cultural theory term, right? And it's just that. It's the copy of something that doesn't have an original.
And you used a couple of examples.
Certainly, I think social media is sort of offers a lot of good examples of that, in how we interact and how we like things on Facebook and our friends. It's sort of replicating an act that is not the real act, right, of liking something or being friends with somebody. If you've been to Venice,
use the Venetian Hotel.
The Venetian in Las Vegas, right. That's a replica of Venice made inside, but it's not the real thing, right? It's not supposed to be the real thing. It's supposed to be better than. And I think advertising today can oftentimes be just that. It's a replica of something that never existed. Specifically when it comes to sustainability and marketing, we see that a lot where they create this pastoral past that was perfect. And they say, we can go back to this time. Or they project into the future when everything is clean and perfect and everybody's healthy, thanks to their product, of course.
But when we talk about advertising and marketing, and please be gentle here, this is the building that marketing built.
Yep.
But I'm kidding, of course, because I think it's I've studied a little bit, not formally, as Deb knows, at Needham High School during my 5 years of taking wood shop. They didn't have behavioral science, and that was like the extent of my education. But we talk about all the time in terms of our marketing paradigms for our clients a concept of emotional investment. We have a metric that shows 6 different levels of emotional investment. And I first stumbled upon that paradigm when I was teaching as an adjunct years ago. I taught at 4 universities, and I was trying to explain how marketing worked, how sponsorship worked, how it motivated people to do something, to buy something, try something, visit somewhere. And I was standing in front of a classroom of undergrad students, and there were about 30 students, and I couldn't get my point across. And so I went outside of the classroom. This was in Columbia, South Carolina, University of South Carolina. And there was a kid walking by. His name was Jimmy. I don't know why I remember that, but Jimmy. So I said, "Hey, Jimmy." I didn't know Jimmy. I said, "Jimmy, do you have a second?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure, creepy professor." So Jimmy came into the classroom. And I said, "Jimmy, we don't know each other, do you?" And he goes, no. And all the kids were looking. And I go, "Hey, okay, here's the deal, Jimmy. Any chance this weekend you can drive me to the airport? I'm flying somewhere and I really need to get to the airport to go to Chicago." And Jimmy was like, "What?" And he goes, "I don't know, creepy professor. I'm not going to." And I said, "Okay, well, next weekend my wife wants to repaint our dining room in kind of an eggshell white kind of thing. I prefer, kind of a glossy, kind of more earth tone, but she wants egg." And he goes, I go, "Can you help paint?" He goes, "No." And so I go, okay. And then he backed out of the room and probably ran down and told the dean or the provost that some professor pulled him into a classroom. And I didn't say anything else to the class. So 40 minutes later, the class is getting ready to end. And this was about, four weeks into the semester. And then I turned to a couple of students in the front row and I said to this one student, I don't remember her name, but let's say it was Susan. I said, "Hey, Susan, would you give me a ride this weekend to the airport?" She goes, yeah, sure. Turned to another kid, Freddie, would you help paint?" They said, "Yes." And from that, I developed this this chart and this system where the natural state of emotional investment between people is zero. Like between you and I met, if we bumped into each other in the street, depending on which street, if it was New York at 2 a.m., there'd be negative emotional investment. But there wouldn't be any... there isn't any natural sense that people will really go out of their way for other people. And on the other side of the continuum is 100% of emotional investment, where it's what most of us typically feel for our family members. So my wife and I have 3 kids. If anyone in my family needed a leg, or if you're talking about medical stuff like bone marrow or kidney, you would do whatever for family. But in this point between zero emotional investment, which is the base point, and 100%, is, I think, where behavior changes. And on that continuum, we've mapped out a number of steps that involves awareness, advocacy, understanding, and depending on your product, your service, the environment, and the message, you can be scientific on where does behavior change, depending on how big the product is or depending on how big the ask is. And so the idea of behavioral science to me is fascinating, and it's not just advertising or putting a brand out there. It's understanding the psychology.
Do you think that's is that a human issue or is that an American issue?
Of caring?
I think of tribalism, right? And of individualism first.
I think it is greatly amplified in America.
Sure.
We have a parochial sense. We have a... you go over to Europe and it's not that way.
Right.
In fact, I'm going to China in a couple of weeks.
You go to China,
yeah.
If you ask somebody over there to paint your house, do you think they're going to say yes?
No, because everyone, I'm going to be going to Singapore and Hong Kong. Everybody's wearing those pollution masks. So I don't know if they'll say yes. I don't think they'll even stop.
Well, I'm just curious as to why you think they're different over there, and we're, as Americans, are different here.
Oh, I think everything's different when you travel around the world.
Yeah, everything is different. I mean, I guess my question was coming from, we have a very individual culture, whereas specifically Europe, maybe not so much in Asia, but certainly from a familial perspective in Asia, Europe, they have a much more of a we community, a we perspective. Socialism, right, is about the we, not the me.
Right.
I think that gets tangled up, and that makes behavior change very, very much harder than I think in other places, where you have to create the tribe, and you have to really make that connection with someone, which is why experiential marketing works better, I think, than most marketing at those things. You know, my favorite campaign was one that Tide did, and it was so when there was hurricanes and tornadoes, they would show up at these towns that had just been devastated. With 18-wheelers, they'd roll up the sides of the 18-wheelers with laundry machines. And all they did was laundry for people.
Yeah. I think it's an agency in New Hampshire, Jay Gunder, that did that.
Such a great campaign. Yeah. I mean, it had so much cultural value. It had brand value. It had community value.
Right.
It was such a nice – and it was so on brand that it was kind of perfect.
Yeah. It's that empathetic connection. I also think the difference between America and international or around the world – is that they play the long game, you know? And
sure.
I was I don't mean to country drop, like name dropping, but...
Oh, go right ahead.
I was in Moscow speaking a few years ago, and I was talking about sports business and event marketing to a giant room of... It was sponsored through the sport ministry. And I was talking about how baseball helped us in our depression. And this guy I was with leaned over and said, you know, you just condensed thousands of years of their history to kind of like a bad baseball metaphor. And his point was, you go over there, and whether it's the architecture, or whether it's the political systems or the social systems, they are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old, sometimes thousands. And that even, there's a nice segue to sustainability there. They look at whether it's how they build things or how they construct things with materials. We have a new building here, which I think you just visited a few minutes ago. The only place we could get high-performing, triple-glazed windows was Lithuania.
Mm.
And so when the architect and the builder said, hey, we need to send, I had to look on a map about Lithuania, which I think is a Baltic state, which is going through its own kind of challenges with Russia right now. And I said, we don't make, and the answer is, because 99% of doors and windows in America are built to a standard that meets kind of the mortgage standard. Like if you get a 20 or 30-year-old mortgage, you want the core materials to last for the mortgage, so the banks kind of require that threshold of durability. Whereas in Europe, they're like, we're going to be around for hundreds and hundreds of years. Why would we want to build something with cheap materials or materials that are designed to break down after 20 decades?
Yeah, and that's the cultural stuff that I, you know, so I, both of my businesses really operate well at the intersection of sustainability and culture. So we do a lot of behavior change stuff. We do a lot of employee engagement. And America has you know, our mythology is very individual, right? It's the cowboy on the range. It's right. It's the founding fathers, you know, breaking out on their own. It's Manifest Destiny, Lewis and Clark type stuff.
Yeah.
And the things we consume and how we consume reflects that. Single serving size everything, right? Starts to reflect your own mythology. So from a cultural perspective, when we look at sustainability, we say it all starts at the cultural level and changing ideologies, right? And then you can start working on the behavior thing. It's one thing to sort of incentivize or get people to make a few behavior change, but it's systemic, and that's ideology change, and it's looking at the broader context of every decision we make. That's hard stuff. It's fun. That's why I like doing what I do, but it's hard.
I agree. We have John Rooks here. He's CEO of Rapport and founder of Soap Group. Talk a little bit about in the TEDx talk you did, you talked about your heirloom
design.
Yeah. And you used an example, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah. So, the example I used was this Rolex watch, right? And it was, there's an industrial designer named Saul Griffith who uses this. It's his analogy. And he actually uses two points. He says, when his son is the right age, he's going to give him a Mont Blanc pen and a Rolex watch and say, this is the only pen you'll ever need in your life.
Right.
This is the only watch you'll ever need in your life. And it's that sort of moment of, you know, not needing something that's disposable, but something that does have a lifetime with it, that makes it more valuable than the cost of it, because it's now special. It's your watch. It's the only one you'll ever need. That's a special watch.
Right.
It's not a disposable, you know, timepiece. And I just love that concept of thinking about things as experiences, as memories, as sort of a fabric of yourself, as opposed to maybe a brand that's literally a representation of
or
what you want
the
your
latest
fabric to be.
iPhone, right. Or what's the latest TV or video right. game, something that is on the kind of longer continuum of
yeah.
life.
Yeah, and I think consumers are looking for those experiences. I think this is getting co-opted, but that's to be expected. Consumers are looking for those experiences.
Yeah.
You see, you know, there's 400% more farmers markets today than there were 3 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so people want that experience. You know, local is more trusted than organic when people are buying food.
Local's powerful because it has that emotional connection. We all care more about our own backyard, literally or figuratively,
exactly right.
as
that's
opposed
exactly,
to
that's
something.
That tribe. It's that tribe.
Before we get off the Rolex thing, I don't know how your eyesight is.
Horrible.
We'll see if you can read the inscription in the back of that watch over there.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. No. It's engraved. It's engraved in the on the back of the face.
Oh, back of the face. I need longer arms.
Well, it's okay. We're all getting older.
Yep.
Yeah, and even I can't read it. It's dated 9/3/2003. So I didn't set this up. I didn't know you were coming here unless I was in some sort of crazy DeLorean time machine.
Yeah.
So this was like 12 years ago. It says Zachary, laugh, live, and love, carpe diem, dad.
Nice. Yeah.
And so I gave when my son was born, I gave him this watch, just like your friend, what was his
name?
Saul.
Yeah.
And it was from the moment he was like, you know, 2 years old to this week, every once in a while, he'll be like, hey, dad, when do I get the watch? And I go, okay, we'll try it on.
Yeah.
And the idea is when he graduates school, he's already been given the watch because I wanted something that was both meaningful, something that had some level of permanence, but something that was thought out when he was born as opposed to...
It's more than a watch.
It's more than a watch.
Yeah.
How cool is that? Did you know that story?
I did not.
Right here.
It's very nice.
The dark underbelly of the story is that it's a fake Rolex from Times Square.
That doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's not a fake Rolex. It's a decent watch. Anyhow, we have John Rooks here. So talk about what type of clients and what type of work do you do both with Soap and Rapport, and what is the mission of those two companies, and where do they overlap, and where are they distinct?
Yeah, so easiest way to talk about Soap is to give an example. So we worked with Interface Carpet, who I'm sure you're aware of, and we did their global employee engagement platform. So the the short story of interfaces, they, in 96, they set a goal, Ray Anderson, their founder, set a goal to have zero environmental impact by 2020. And we started working with them 3 or 4 years ago, and they were having this internal dialogue of, did Ray mean January 2020 or December 2020? Because it's getting close. So we went around the world. We were in Australia, Thailand, Northern Ireland, Amsterdam, all over the place, working with their factory employees, helping them see their job through the lens of sustainability. So the third shift tufting machine operator in Thailand had just as much to say about sustainability as anybody else. And we worked with 2,000 employees, and we brought a documentary film crew with us and documented the entire process. So we did workshops. And what we did was we started sharing these little mini docs, 12, 15-minute little documentaries around to the other facilities so they could get a sense of how big this thing really was. And this legacy that Ray Anderson started was still moving, and they still had a long way to go. I mean, part of behavior change is you have to create a sense of urgency, otherwise it doesn't happen.
Right.
So we wanted to create that urgency. So that was one project. It was about a 2-year project that we did with Interface. Those are the types of programs that the SOAP Group does.
And with Rapport, is it Rapport.io?
That's the URL is Rapport.io. So one thing that's hard, it's hard to scale a consulting business, sort of an hourly consulting business like the SOAP Group. And I really wanted something that could scale both financially, but also from an impact perspective. And what I saw was large companies were writing procurement policies requiring environmental data from their supply chains. So the Home Depots of the world were reaching into their suppliers saying, I've measured my footprint. Now I want to know what part of my footprint you make up.
And that's for the last couple of decades, there's been, I think, some movement in areas of both diversity, of gender representation. Sure. I think there's an overlap between government policy, good social policy, and corporate policy when companies use their power to not necessarily force good, but to recognize it and to value it in some way, to help positive change.
Yeah, right? And they're better companies when they do that. I mean, they perform better. Even from a stock market perspective, they perform better. So Rapport helps those companies in the supply chain, the small and mid-sized businesses, track their environmental footprint and share it with their customers so they can win and maintain contracts. But it also, one of the next features that's being built is a best practice sharing module. So, think of it like an Amazon recommendation engine. So you go to Amazon, it says, people like you have also bought these 4 books. Now, Rapport users will log in and it'll say, companies like yours have done these 4 things to reduce their environmental footprint. Switch to LEDs, low-flow toilets, whatever those environmental things are. And it'll show a payback period, a cost, and then you can adopt that principle. So it becomes sort of a community sharing platform as well as a sustainability tool. But what the sort of the magic is, it's designed for small and mid-sized businesses who until now have been left out of the sustainability conversation.
When you look at sustainability and you look at kind of our overall, this is going to be really existential, overall existence in the planet. You know, we're hurling through space at 30,000 something miles per hour. We have limited fuel source relative to fossil fuels, which I think we should obviously move away from as quickly as possible. So we have to change, and there's big issues and big global issues on whether we change and India, China doesn't change. What does that mean? But I think we all have to take personal responsibility, and I think governments have to take constitutional responsibility. But you talk about corporations quite a bit. Where do you think the biggest segment or biggest sector of change can be? You know, is it government policy? Because government has the size and the power to mandate change, whether it was environmental change with pollution in the 50s and 60s when they used to dump toxic materials into rivers and waterways, whether it's economic change and taxation.
That was back when they could get things done.
Back when, whether it was good or not, things were definitely getting done.
Right.
But And then, you know, so there's corporations which have a different motivation. Most public companies, their chief mandate is to stockholders and shareholders. Sure. And many times that's in conflict with doing the right thing. And then you have consumers and individuals. You know, where has most of your focus been, and where do you think is the most fertile area for meaningful change to happen?
Yeah, so I don't have a lot of faith that we're gonna pass any significant climate change policy that's going to do anything, right? Short of a very aggressive cap and trade, but I just don't see it happening. I see businesses doing a ton and changing, right? So, I mean, Walmart's such a great example. I mean, they're so, you know, they're such an easy villain, right?
Right.
But from an environmental perspective, they design to more aggressive standards than LEED, and they don't certify LEED standards, right? Because it saves them money. Their whole mission is to save money for their customers, and they do that by driving waste out of their supply chain. Now, they've got their own social issues and their own governance issues, and there's some other things going on from a sustainability perspective.
Right.
But I see from an environmental perspective a lot of companies being very, very serious about this and doing it because it helps their pocketbook. All right, so the line sort of that I always use is the first 50% of sustainability pays for itself. It's just lean manufacturing. It's just efficiencies. It's just, you know, Ray Anderson, sort of back to Interface, used to say that waste is just excessive cost for your consumer. So it's you have an obligation to drive waste out of your systems, whether it's literal waste or figurative waste or any inefficiencies.
So you don't think government, let's talk about government in the sense of federal government or international government, and also in terms of Maine, and then also in terms of local municipalities. Because government occurs and functions on all these different levels. Here in Maine, how would you rate our sensitivity as, you know, there's 1.3 million people, just over 1.3 million people here in Maine. Is Maine a more progressive state? Is Southern Maine and Portland, which has some fantastic boutique coffee shops and microbrew and other fun kind of progressive music, cultural scenes, but are we really progressive on these issues involving climate, sustainability, energy? Yeah. And is Maine in the middle of the pack? And where do you see Maine's government either being leading or being ineffective in these issues?
Yeah, I've always thought that Portland, Maine, and Portland, Oregon should be in a fight to see who could be more the most sustainable city. You know,
we were first, right?
Yeah, I mean, we were. Yeah, yeah. It was going to be Portland or Boston, Oregon. I think was the other option that they were looking at.
That's funny.
The story is they flipped a coin. I think things like the bag ban are interesting. I mean, I think that's a progressive move. Whether or not it's the right environmental move, that's part of the everything can be proven that, you know, that it doesn't, it's not a big step in the right direction. I think it's a very visible step, and that often matters more. I'm not confident in government being the solution to climate change. I think that global government, sure, right? Global decisions on that level are. And I think that municipalities, I'm interested in the margins, right? Mm-hmm. Global politics and local politics. And I don't have a ton of patience for the middle stuff, which seems pretty ineffective to me. I like doing stuff locally, and I like thinking globally. And if once I get into the middle, it's too polarizing. It's too poisonous, right? Specifically, U.S. politics is just so poisonous that it almost hurts to talk about.
Well, you know, you're going to make me cry here, John Rooks, because I have been, Deb, as you know, how sensitive I am on this subject.
Yes,
very. I've been involved with local and state politics, and boy, I've been kicked around. And by the way, did you see the new column in the Forecaster this week?
I know, but I have the Forecaster in the car.
Yep, you need
so
to read.
I will.
You need
yep.
to read that. I agree with what you just said, but I also think in a representative democracy, which is what we have, which is for our system, when you match it with capitalism, I think a pretty effective machine. But it only works when people are engaged. And I watched this crazy Donald Trump thing last night in Dallas, where CNN, MSNBC, and it wasn't even like a big debate. It was just the Donald talking to 20,000 people. And there was like these rabid fans. And he wasn't saying anything. He was like, oh, I'm going to build the wall. It's going to be a beaut. It is going to be. And we've our political process has evolved or devolved to the point where it doesn't really matter what a person's competency is or what they can do. It's, can we relate with either their anger? Can we relate with other, sometimes more superficial kind of benchmarks? And I believe in a representative democracy here in Maine, I think we have 917,412 registered voters, that each person has to play the role. And as a nation of laws, whether they're local town ordinances or whether they're lawmaking in Augusta, that's the system that gets stuff done. But those people all report to voters. Mm-hmm. And I think voters have failed.
Yeah, and I would agree.
And I think a big part of it is after the Industrial Revolution and after really the Vietnam War, which is the last military action, we had a draft. People weren't that emotionally, you know, back then people were emotionally connected. When the country was founded, you know, we were in this, you know, conflict with England and it was life or death. So when they picked the founders, or the founders kind of like rose to the top, you know, Jefferson and Adams, it wasn't like Larry, Moe, and Curly. It was who are the best and the brightest. We need them. And instinctively we knew, or our forefathers knew, our survival depended on smart people, smart ideas, and people all pulling together. And in other periods of U.S. history, when we've had challenges with the Depression, World War II, military challenges, we've gravitated towards finding, you know, personal sacrifice and finding smart people to lead us. But since we don't have that sense of doom, and since on an individual basis, nobody's really afraid of Canada attacking us, then I think we've gotten lazy and we don't pursue or respond or respect or recognize competency and leadership, and it's become one big game show.
Yeah. Well, Donald Trump is the simulacrum, right? Yeah. He is a parody of himself. Right.
He looks like a cartoon. And when absolutely. He talks, you like laugh.
Right. Right. But that's kind of what we deserve. We, you know, it started with, you know, I like Bush because I could see me having a beer with him. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
And that becomes, I want a relationship with somebody that I share ideologies with. I want my own tribe in the White House.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what people vote for, is they vote based on their own ideologies. Science be damned. Right. And that's, you know, and I think you're absolutely right that you have to be active in politics. I just don't have a lot of faith in people being active. There's not a lot of track record of that happening. Things are exciting right now. Right. But I still think the business has a better shot at doing something about sustainability than specifically the U.S. government does.
What's the motivation for businesses, unless it can be clearly quantified, that sustainable practices, whether it's LED lighting or renewable energy sources or solar or radiant heat or low flow facilities, what is the motivation for companies to invest when there is no short-term payoff, because we're in a short-term cycle, whether mm-hmm. it's the financial pressure of quarterly reports, whether it's on an annual year-to-year basis, it feels like for most American business, they're not able to play the long game. It's all very, you know, it's so competitive that nobody can say, oh, this is the right thing to do because 10 years from now, it'll have a better impact on the environment, when that executive and that company is worried about getting through that quarter of business.
Yeah. So I think that's changing, right? As somebody who reads sustainability reports and CSR reports for a living, there's a lot of really good things going on. And when you see companies like Chipotle coming out saying, we need to do something about climate change because in 5 years, the price of avocados is going to be through the roof and guac is definitely going to be extra then, right? They're making changes, engaging their consumer, changing the way they do practice to save their business from the future. So a lot of it might just be risk mitigation. That's a long game, right?
Right.
We won't be around, right? That's the old scenario planning, right, from the old BP days. So I think a lot of it's risk mitigation. The other part of it is millennials entering the job force, wanting to work for companies that they share the values of. That's a big driver as well.
Out of the corner of my head, I saw our resident millennial, Emily, shaking her head, nodding like a bobblehead over there, like, yes, yes. Does that resonate with you there, Emily?
It definitely does. You want to work with someone who you can get behind, who you can share those sort of beliefs with.
Is it possible, though, to be too idealistic? And here in Southern Maine, I'm going to say something, Deb, if hit the delete button, if this is just too out there and okay. Controversial. There's a lot of people, particularly in digital and social media in Southern Maine, where, you know, I respect what they're doing. I respect anyone who has a strong point of view or advocacy for what they really believe in. But there's, I believe, a gap between just raw idealism in being realistic and practical relative to business. And I think being idealist is important to push change, but there are times where it doesn't feel realistic. It doesn't. Some of the in Portland, what was the Tea Party thing where everyone camped out up on the top of
Occupy Maine?
Yeah, Occupy Maine. There's some real issues. There's some real structural issues in our economy. There's some real issues where income inequality is a real, real issue that isn't just about let's tax wealthy people more. It's about a fundamental platform of commerce and capitalism that's fair to people. Mm-hmm. It's not just a redistribution. And what's happened, I believe, in the last 40 years is the people with power have gravitated to more power. And they've associated with more people with power, whether it's in the judicial branch and the way our legal system works or healthcare. And so the people with the wealth and the power have designed the game and they judge the game for their own benefit. And that has to change. But the, you know, just kind of the impulsive sense of companies are bad or wealthy people are bad or we need to. That feels like it goes too far because it doesn't get to the thoughtful issue. There shouldn't be such income inequality. There shouldn't be such tax policy that allows people on the wealthy end of the spectrum not to pay their share. And we should have a system that serves the interest of all of us, where if a person wakes up in America and they put in 40 hours of work, there should be enough checks and balances in terms of whether it's minimum wage levels, healthcare, benefit levels, that person can earn enough money to sustain themselves.
Right.
And we don't have that now.
Right. And culture change happens. So we do a lot of change management. And culture change happens two ways. It happens peacefully over time, or it happens violently short.
With the pitchforks.
That's right. That's right. And so what we're seeing right now is a slow culture change in the U.S. And part of that change is sustainability, right? Part of it is social justice. It's sort of all tangled up to each other in each other. But the more complex the culture and diverse the culture, the harder it is, and the slower and the longer it's going to take.
We have John Rooks here. He's CEO of Rapport, founder of Soap Group. You can find their information online, their agency information. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. John, let's pivot a little bit and talk about your book, More Than Promote, A Monkey Wrencher's Guide to Authentic Marketing. How do you define authentic marketing, and what are the key elements of your guide?
Three things. We think that authentic marketing has three points of value. It has corporate value, has a return on the investment for the corporation. It has civic value, meaning it does something good for the community. And it also has cultural value, meaning it changes the conversation for the better. That's when we see authentic marketing, those are the three things we look for.
And for that book, which I think you have online for free, right?
Yeah. But we have.
Where do people find that if they're interested in looking into that?
Best way for them to find it is to go to thesoapgroup.com, and you can find
and
it.
And there's
find
links.
A link to,
on
there's links there to find it. Yeah.
And what are some of the ways, whether it's corporation, civics, or cultural, that you give people, tools to tap into that?
Yeah. So the book really sort of walks through a process that evolved into something that we call authenticity audits, which if you want to clear a room of CEOs, of C-suite executives, tell them you're there for the authenticity audit, and they'll all run screaming.
That's funny.
But what we do is we go into companies and we look at what they're saying and compare that to what they're doing. Right,
it's kind of walking the walk or talking the talk. Every company says they're green, they care about the environment, but do they have styrofoam? Do they have composting? Do they have electric charging stations?
Yeah, and sometimes it's more, a lot of times it's hidden. So we did this for a financial services institution who had a very aggressive policy, HR policy, to make a safe workspace and recruit within the LGBTQ community. Right, it was part of their mission. They were open about it. And when we went through and looked at all the different parts of their business, we looked at their charitable giving, and we realized that they were donating to the Boy Scouts, which was at the time fairly controversial over that.
Because of their policy in terms of Scoutmasters. And
this was sort of a pet donation, 100 grand a year or something, that a few CEOs ago had sort of implemented, and it got institutionalized into the company. No one ever would have made the connection between their inclusiveness of the LGBTQ community and that corporate donation, which was a line item somewhere in a spreadsheet, right? And so what we were able to do is find that moment of inauthenticity. It wasn't intentional. It rarely is, right? We were able to find that for them, and they could address it. It was, so they avoided the risk of someone in their business finding it and saying, hey, you're not authentic. But it also gave them an opportunity to prove their commitment to the policy by addressing it. So the authenticity gap, right? The difference between what you say and you do. Rarely is it intentionally deceiving. It's often a blind spot for them. But within that gap, we find risks like that. But we also find opportunities for innovation and places where they could refocus with their money or their efforts to be more on brand, on culture. And oftentimes we drive those solutions through sustainability.
Interesting. I'd love to have you come back sometime. We've run out of time, John, but to me, I think this is fascinating. I think it's interesting for people to hear this perspective and how it's not just government, it's not just companies, it's not just individuals, but it's really a collaboration. It's how all those parts kind of fit together.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate it. Thanks.
It's great having you. We've had John Rooks here. He is the CEO of Rapport and founder of Soap Group. You can find information for the Soap Group at thesoapgroup.com. And also his online book is available. Yeah, you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. We'll be back next week. Thank you.